I'm John Batchelor with David Davenport of the Hoover Institution. His new book, along with the late Professor Gordon Lloyd, Equality of Opportunity. Woodrow Wilson, president of Princeton, eventually the governor of New Jersey. He's not a political thinker. He's trained in political science, which was at that time frontier thinking. But he comes to the presidency in a country that's divided between the progressives and the conservatives, the reactionaries, the way life used to be. One progressive is Woodrow Wilson. One progressive is Theodore Roosevelt. And as David and his colleague write quite charmingly, Wilson just happened to be a Democrat. He was mostly a progressive. And the thinking here is the opportunity of the frontier is now ended. They're dating the close of the frontier in 1890. What did that mean to the progressives? David, why did they believe that was a driver for their reforms?
Their argument, John, is an interesting one, and that is that, yes, individualism and equality might have worked rather naturally without a lot of government intervention when we had a free and open frontier, when Americans who wanted a greater opportunity could simply move west, in many cases get free land, begin their lives in a new place. My home state of Kansas was heavily populated by people who came and claimed free land. But by 1890, the U.S. Census Bureau declared that the western frontier was closed, that there were no new frontiers to be conquered. And the progressives saw this, I think, as their opportunity to rethink government. And their argument is, if we could get equality naturally because of free land, we now no longer have that opportunity. Americans were going to have to live in cities. Things were going to be more crowded. We were going to have much more government intervention. At the same time that the free land was disappearing, America was moving from an agrarian economy to an industrial economy. And the progressives feared industrial growth and the titans of industry overtaking the common man and making equality almost impossible for the common man to obtain. So in their view, it was time now for government to step up and to be a direct player on the field of creating equality of opportunity. It was no longer enough to depend on free land and free markets to do that. The government was going to have to create equality of opportunity.
The irony here is you write that Wilson looked more to Bonaparte than he did to the French Revolution. What does that mean, David?
Well, there are a lot of interesting contradictions in Wilson, as you would well know. He has two things there that interest me philosophically. And as you say, he was an academic political scientist. He had studied Congress and written about Congress in depth. One of the interesting arguments is he says the founders were more Newtonian with their checks and balances and so forth, whereas government ought to be more Darwinian. It ought to evolve. That was kind of a clever argument. But as you say, ironically, he didn't look to the French Revolution as other philosophers of the progressive movement sometimes did. He looked to Bonaparte, because Bonaparte had a very active role for the government and obviously was a form of dictator. And that's one of the ironies of the progressive movement. While defending and protecting the common man, they chose to do it with a very strong federal government. And Wilson took the lead in establishing that.
Yes, the ironies are everywhere. When we come to Wilson, especially, a scientific administrative state. Did he use those words?
Yes. Oh, yes. He felt that rather than politics being the core of government and the people, debating and arguing and so forth, he felt that much of government should simply be run by scientific experts. And so the rise of the administrative state, where he thought expert administrators really should take the lead away from the people. Again, another irony, because the progressives claim they're protecting the people, but the way they go about it is not by giving the people more power, it's by giving bureaucrats and administrators more power. And to him, yes, that was the science of government.
He saw himself as not limited by the Constitution. What does that mean, David? How did he interpret that?
Well, he felt that the Constitution was, as I mentioned earlier, it should be an evolving document. And just as government should evolve, the Constitution should evolve. His successor, Franklin Roosevelt, two or three decades later, would say, well, remember, the first three words of the Constitution are "we the people." So if we the people want to make a change and want things to be done differently, they can. And so part of the progressive movement, the irony is a lot of the progressive movement occurred really without constitutional amendments. It came by changes in federal and executive power. And so they did not feel constrained by the Newtonian constitution of James Madison, as they put it. But they thought it was time for the Darwinian evolving constitution and one that met the needs of the people.
Yes, but they did take on the amendments. And I had never associated all of these with Wilson, yes. But I see it. Yes. It's his time, the 16th, 17th, 18th, and 19th. Let's go especially to the 19th. Wilson resisted suffrage for a long time. He avoided it at the White House, but eventually the progressives did pass suffrage, and that was seen as a great breakthrough. At the same time, they were keen on labor and civil rights. It all happened all in a very short period of time. The puzzle here is, how did this connect to the first war, to the questions about the war? Was that understood as progressive to get involved in the war?
We don't really address that in our book, and I have to admit I'm not an expert on that. And you're right that ironically, I would say the war at least created an opportunity for change. It caused the American people to look more to the presidency, which is exactly what Wilson wanted. And if the president had commander-in-chief powers over the military, then it wasn't such a long stretch to give him commander-in-chief powers in the domestic arena. In fact, again, I keep coming back to Roosevelt. Roosevelt would later say in the Second World War that we needed to make progressive changes just like we are making changes in the international arena. And we could declare war on the domestic front just as we could declare war on the international front. So you're right that both Wilson and Roosevelt drew much greater power, commander and chief power, from the two world wars that they then tried to carry over into the domestic arena.
So equality of opportunity for Wilson was the government must get involved in order to offset the power of he called them, I believe, the titans, the barons of industry. So it was active government.
Yes, there were really two agendas. He and Teddy Roosevelt, of course, were strongest on, we must now regulate the economy.
Right.
We cannot trust a free market economy to protect the little guy.
Let's go to the extreme then. We go to the crisis of the Depression. The book is Equality of Opportunity Over the Centuries of the American Republic. David Davenport of the Hoover Institution, the late Professor Gordon Lloyd. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.